With me in this morning, I have John Coombs, community strategist and catalyst for positive change, and our guest, Rod Oram. Rod has had 30 years' experience in the international financial arena, been a journalist, worked in Europe and North America for leading publications such as the Financial Times of London, where he worked for 18 years. He was also based in London and New York and has travelled extensively through North America, Europe and Asia. Rod and his family immigrated from the UK to New Zealand in 97, and he is currently a columnist for the Sunday Star Times, a regular broadcast on radio and television, frequent public speaker on business and economic issues, and an occasional correspondent to the Financial Times. He was here as the business editor for the New Zealand Herald back in 1997 to 2000. Presently, Rod's an adjunct professor in the New Zealand Centre for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Unitec, and also he's a recipient of many awards. Recently, Rod has come out with a far more lucid understanding of climate change and the remedies that need to be taken than the major New Zealand political parties. Yet, to get media traction and business support, it is the challenge of the moment. He sets out pointers for New Zealand to fulfil Kyoto greenhouse protocols, become a carbon-neutral, innovative global leader, and particular, a moral indicator for other countries. In Rod's words, if we took bold, sensible steps on energy and the environment over the next decade, we could enhance our standard of living, our quality of life, and our reputation in the world. So, good morning, Rod.
Well, kia ora, good morning.
Rod, recently you came out and set in very clear terms that climate change is upon us and that we as a nation need to get serious as to what consequences may prevail and what the government needs to do to clarify its policy. Can you explain?
The big issues of climate change have obviously been with us for a long time, but it seems to me that over the last couple of years, we've started to see a shift around the world in terms of more people locking onto this. And crucially, from my point of view as a business journalist, seeing businesses starting to respond. And one of the high points of that business trend was in May of last year, when General Electric, one of the, largest industrial companies in the world, announced a very big change of strategy around its own emissions of greenhouse gases, around its own energy use, but crucially around its own investment in R&D and in product development for equipment, products, services that make sense in that view of climate change, and setting themselves some very ambitious goals for how much of their revenues, what proportion their R&D would go into and come from these fields. And there's no doubting the seriousness of that, and that's only one of many companies that are starting to lock onto that. So I became interested from that point of view of wondering what New Zealand businesses were doing. And as I've been tracking that over recent years, I feel that, by and large, these are issues that New Zealand business doesn't take seriously. They see any discussion of climate change as a cost imposed on them by the government, whether it be a carbon charge or whatever, and failing to see it as an opportunity to invest in their businesses and run them better, be lower energy use, as well as lower greenhouse gas emissions, and they're making themselves more competitive and more credible out there in the world market. And so that's why from the beginning of this year I started to address those issues much more directly. The first main outing for that was a public lecture here on the Unitec campus in a few months ago, and I've since then been ensuring that every presentation I do, and I do a lot of speaking engagements, has at least one small part of the presentation around those issues, because I'm making the case that the impact on New Zealand in economic and other terms is very big. And then I've had on a few occasions the chance to devote a whole presentation, say a full hour, to that subject, and I've done that with a number of industry groups, and I've been very pleasantly surprised. I feel the mood, I feel the response is beginning to change very slightly to a more positive one. So that's the general background of the issues I've been exploring and taking public, particularly this year.
Very good. Because when I go up on the internet and I have a look at the policies, and there's different groups, there's Department for the Environment, there's also the forestry side of things, and transport, there's no pulling these threads together to lay out something that most New Zealanders can understand and say, yes, we can support. How do you see this?
That's why possibly this year is going to turn out to be a very crucial one in this. If you look back to what the current government has done over recent years, it was certainly bold to sign up to the Kyoto Protocol. But then the policy framework that came around that was very inadequate in a number of ways. And not the least of which, the important concept of putting a price on carbon, so there would be a carbon charge, which would have only turned out to be, I think it was going to be about 7 cents a litre, to fully reflect the cost of those carbon dioxide emissions. That central mechanism of pricing carbon into fuels was hijacked by Treasury, because Treasury said, no, it's really bad government practice to have taxes targeted at particular areas and then taking the revenue from that and reapplying them somewhere. All tax revenues should just go into the general revenue fund and then be used in different ways. So because Treasury captured the carbon charge in that way, it was not possible for the government under that original plan to recycle those revenues from the carbon charge into helping industries or businesses invest in new technology to help make this transition. So that was one of the big problems. So come last December, the government finally pulled the plug on the carbon charge, believing it didn't have enough political support in Parliament post the election last year. And once you pull that element out of the picture, then a lot of other things don't start to make sense. So the government announced, well, we'll have a complete review of our climate change policy. And as a step in that, there was a whole-of-government review. The report was came out under the imprimatur of the Ministry for the Environment, but again, you could detect the very heavy hand of Treasury all the way through this document in December. It basically reopened up all the issues as to what this framework should look like. So now here we are in August, and the work is moving at a very glacial pace. The relevant minister, David Parker, has been working hard. Obviously had a bit of a time out from the portfolio while there were some questions about his business dealings, which are all settled and he's back in the job. But the state of play at the moment is the government has laid out an unbelievably complicated policy framework workload. It's about climate change. It's about energy. It just goes on and on and on. And theoretically, all of these pieces could eventually come together in a very, very coherent policy. But I would have two very major reservations about that. First of all, I think it's so complex it'll be hard to get all the pieces together. Now, at some point in the distant future, all the pieces have to fit together, but I don't think you have to start with the magnificent, complete conception. So I think it's going to be very hard to pull together rapidly in a coherent way. Secondly, I think it's going to be very hard to persuade the public that this huge thing they've now got to get their head around will work, they need to engage with, or whatever. And then thirdly, and in many ways one of the more crucial issues, is that any of these ways of dealing with climate change and any energy issues need to be a very long-term policy framework. There is a phrase that's being used out there in the in the business community that locks on, the part of the business community that locks on to these issues, that they want a long, loud, and legal framework. They want to know exactly where they stand and that it's going to be for a long time and it's very clear what's going on, so then they can invest and plan accordingly. But we're on a 3-year election cycle in New Zealand, and it would be very easy to see when, should there be the next change of government, bring, say, a national-led government into power, that National would want to rethink the whole thing again and would want to start changing all sorts of aspects of this. Well, that's just pretty much the worst thing that could happen. The primary, you know, one of the biggest goals now is to try to get a political consensus cross-party so that this is a long, loud, and legal framework. And I've raised that issue with both main parties, and they very loosely say, oh, well, I suppose that'd be a good idea. But they have no intention of driving for it. And that, for me, is the biggest overall weakness as to where we're trying to go over the next year or so, is that lack of a political consensus.
Yeah, bipartisan, in this case for these two parties, is imperative. America will always work together with the two major parties, will always quite often vote with each other and find ways to work together. But we have this difficulty here in New Zealand, and it's a great pity because Sweden have already made a date, 2020, to be fossil fuel free. And of course, at the moment, Britain is looking at a carbon card. Now, these are ideas that are still foreign to us in New Zealand, and yet we're supposed to be the nimble country who can move quickly. We've got some very clever people in this country. Why is it that we cannot actually get traction in there? Is this the two parties locked down in an old ideology or something?
Oh, there's a large element of that. And, of course, for many people, this just doesn't seem that pressing or urgent an issue. Fortunately, I can think of at least one precedent which is a bit more encouraging, which is is the superannuation debate. And there has been now for about 3 years a political consensus between National and the Labour Party that the Cullen Superannuation Fund will remain in place even if National comes to power. And that while National doesn't particularly like it, they acknowledge it has some value, and so they will keep it in place. But it took years and years and years to get to that point. And on climate change issues, we don't have that luxury of time. Arguably, we didn't have that luxury of time on superannuation either, because that was a real time bomb ticking away. But anyway, at least that was done. I think trying to find a more positive way forward is that... It's just trying to help people understand in New Zealand how important this is. If you look at OECD countries, typically primary production, as in agriculture, is around about 1% of their economic activity, of their GDP. But here in New Zealand, it's around 17%, and both direct and then downstream indirect contribution to the economy. So we're by far, by an order of magnitude of, say, 15 times more dependent on our primary sector than other countries. And therefore, climate change, and I stress change rather than global warming, because this is working both ways. Just as some places are getting a lot drier, others are getting wetter, just as there were stable weather places in some places, now it becomes more unstable. So, and just as some parts of the planet will get a lot hotter, we in New Zealand won't, judging by NIWA's projections, won't have significant temperature changes, but we will have some very significant rainfall changes. So these are all great challenges. And last but in no means least, if you look out into our international markets, the growing sensitivity around environmental issues in general, but climate in particular, are growing very rapidly. A lot of that, of course, for consumers focused around food miles, how much energy is taken to get a food product to the table. And there has been already some very interesting examples in Europe where New Zealand has been singled out because it's the furthest distance that food travels. I have a huge caution on that, though. Whilst I think that's a legitimate thing to look at, most people don't actually often look beyond just the sheer concept. You think, oh my goodness, that lamb, those apples are coming so far, they must have consumed vast amounts of energy to get here. But the fact of the matter, that actually isn't true. Moving things by ship is very efficient. And furthermore, our farming here is a lot less energy intensive than it is in Europe. So if you look at the total expenditure of energy to grow a crop, process it and transport it to market using our farming methods and then efficient seaborne travel, then we're not that far off the mark. But we still have to acknowledge that issue and quantify it and say, yeah, we acknowledge that's the case and we're working on it.
Isn't there another issue here in relation to the opportunities of our agricultural sector to be a lot more organically inclined? There's a worldwide shortage of organic food in the developed world, and this tremendous opportunity for the agricultural sector to be branding itself much more effectively. New Zealand had a Tony O'Reilly, who was running Heinz at the time, was looking to drive what was called an organic oasis in New Zealand, and that fell over in 1998, but it was called Project 98. Now, there was an opportunity that was lost, but there's the opportunity to revisit that and New Zealand to rebrand itself in a much more effective way into Europe and to America and to the developed world.
I think the branding for New Zealand should be around very healthy, very wholesome food, but not just organic, because organic is only part of the market. There is not a particularly significant premium on price for organic over non-organic food, and there will be a lot of people out there who would just be very happy to know that, oh, if it's from New Zealand, it's healthy, of high quality. Having said that, we don't put a great deal of effort as a country into organic compared with others, and it would be good to see more science, more good learning in farming practice going into that area.
I suppose there are two benefits, though, isn't there? There's not just an economic potential advantage, there's also a very good environmental advantage in farming and in that particular way, and that we're going to be reducing a lot of our emissions and we're going to be managing our soil and our water much more effectively.
Possibly, but organic isn't the only way to do that, and it's really important that all agriculture in New Zealand works towards farming practices that do address those issues, and it not be a question of whether that's just organic or not, but whether it's just plain good farming practice. What was, I think, tremendously significant was the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment brought out a wonderfully interesting document, it'd be almost 2 years ago now, called Growing for Good. And in that, Morgan Williams and his staff laid bare some very important analysis as to how energy intensive, how fertilizer intensive, how water intensive large chunks of New Zealand agriculture have become. And unfortunately, the response from sort of the bulk of farmers, as represented by Federated Farmers, was just to rubbish the report and not even enter into any kind of discussion as to the issues there. And unfortunately, you know, that mainstream leadership in farming is still, you know, very seriously in denial over those issues.
With the Kyoto protocols and to be able to sequester CO2 out of the atmosphere, to pull CO2 out and put it away in trees. Now, New Zealand, if it doesn't fulfil these protocols, we've got a $520 million fine to pay up very shortly, and even the National Party said it could be up to $1 billion. Is there a strategy again for New Zealanders be it farmers, be it New Zealand Māori, or be it groups of individuals wanting to get marginal land and plant them in trees to take the CO2 out of its atmosphere. Is there a policy? Because I have heard that a lot of farmers are pulling up their young trees now, their young pine trees, and destroying them because they do not get... Should we say, doesn't come under the government strategy, because the government have actually taken away the so-called their rights for their units or whatever it is of measurement. Pardon?
The carbon credits.
Yeah, the carbon credits. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one?
You touched on about sort of four very, very big issues there. The first one is that when New Zealand signed up to the Kyoto Protocol, the trends looked very promising in terms of our trend rate in growth of greenhouse gas emissions, which was relatively moderate, and the fact we had these very extensive forests planted since 1990, the baseline for Kyoto, and therefore there were good sinks there. But essentially, three big things happened since then. The first one was the economy grew far faster than expected, and energy consumption grew faster, and carbon emissions grew faster than was forecast. So that was on the liability side. But on the asset side, the forestry has been really struggling economically in terms of trying to get any value out of the trees. And therefore, many forest owners were harvesting the trees, but then deciding it wasn't worth replanting because there wasn't a good enough return on those trees. And so we've seen some quite substantial conversions to other apparently more profitable uses. Classically, it's been from forestry to dairy farms. And then the third factor was that some of the methodology around how to quantify that post-1990 forestry and how to calculate what the sink value was, there were some problems in the methodology, particularly around how to count scrubland. And so you put all those three figures together, or those three dynamics together, and all of a sudden what looked quite promising half a dozen years ago now looks a serious financial liability. That's the big context. But then, very specifically, on the forest credits, this is a phenomenally controversial and difficult area, because it at one level, at the top level, it's actually very conceptual. What the government said on the outset of this Kyoto program was there are some very large chunks of the economy which are very large emitters of greenhouse gases. They are our industrial plant. They happen to be animals, ruminant animals, and to some extent other farming practices. Of course, we don't want to suddenly bang on top of those people taxes or charges, but we do want you to work on the issue. We do want you to work on developing different feed for ruminant animals and breed those animals so they're digesting the feed better, so they're not producing methane. But in the meantime, we will take these post-1990 forests and the credits that are probably there, and we will take them onto our own account. The government will take over those for the first Kyoto commitment period, 2008 to 2012. And we'll do that because that's kind of a rough offset against what's happening in farming. But secondly, all this is completely unknown territory. We have no idea what the value of that is. It's very complex to try and work out. And we think it's better that we try to sort out the international frameworks for all that and try to get that up and running, rather than just you hairing off as individual farmer, forest owners to do your own thing. So, of course, now, particularly the farm foresters have said, you've taken a right away from us. Well, I'm not sure that's kept the case. There is a real liability there on farms, and it's not so much the government has taken away an asset from the farmers. It has agreed to handle the asset and the liability at the same time to try and get a new framework for moving forward. Well, the whole thing's a total shambles. There is great tension between the government and particularly the farm foresters, that they can't. It doesn't seem as though they can even be in the same room together and have a discussion without it all getting pretty hot and angry. So what is absolutely essential over the course of, say, the rest of this year, as the government is working through its Mark II version of its climate change policy framework, that all these issues are finally sorted out. Because the great hope is that there is sufficient value in those credits that were we to sell them overseas, they would contribute very positively on that side of the ledger, rather than us having to buy in credits to meet our commitments.
And Rod, could you just complete your last grand equation?
Well, having dealt with where we are today and where the policy framework needs to go, there is, of course, the very, very important third leg of this is how do we transition from a very heavily carbon-based economy, in energy terms, to somewhere different and lot less carbon. And so that's then the other big challenge for government in this policy framework, and that comes on the energy side and the transportation side. It's not at all clear what the government's going to do there. Clearly, we've got a good opportunity in New Zealand for biofuels of various types, and there is a UK company that's very keen to build a biodiesel plant here using tallow from our meatworks, because a lot of that tallow goes overseas at the moment to China, where it's made into soap. So seems like a good idea to make biodiesel instead here. And secondly, Genesis Research and Development, our biggest and best biotechnology company, has a subsidiary called BioJoule, which is working on the plant side of biofuels. And Jim Watson, the founder of Genesis and the founding scientist, is putting pretty much all his work into that, and looking at particular willow cane as a feedstock for those plants. And, you know, one of the first issues that's come up, and it just came up in a conversation I had last week with some farmers, they say, oh, well, you're talking about taking land out of farm production. So, well, no, not necessarily. BioJoule has gone around mapping the country as to climate, terrain, and land use, and believes there are very significant tracts of land that are not used for farming, for food production, that could be used for this now. So there's great opportunities, and they've already got their eye on building a pilot plant at Taupo to test the concepts. But the government... Sorry, it keeps coming back to the government, but the government's got to put a whole bunch of really important policy things in place, such as what's going to be the standard, the quality standard on biofuels, what's going to be the mix, the blend. Is it 5% biofuel and 95% mineral diesel blended as one, or is it going to be, that would be B5, or is it going to be B10, or what? And it would be great to see us move towards energy efficiency and emission standards for vehicles. We're the only OECD country which has neither. There is a large part of the motor industry that are very keen to get these issues sorted, and so they know what sort of cars they should be sourcing to secondhand to bring into the country. And then when we look at electricity, I think quite an interesting loose consensus has been forming amongst the major electricity generators about the short, medium, and longer term outlook for fuel sources. And it's been exciting to see quite a big momentum build for wind farms. Obviously Meridian leading the way on that, but others too, as a sort of a medium term solution. And then much longer term, you know, maybe that it'll be possible to go back to using coal in a completely environmentally responsible way. i.e. capturing the carbon and sequestering it, for example. So anyway, on that, where do we go from here out into the future in terms of our energy sources? That's the other big leg of this.
Yes, I know that fusion, of course, is the holy grail, and so we can still always walk towards it, but it's 50 years away. John, you had a question?
Well, I do, and I think this is really around the role of industry and of individuals, and it's very easy to sort of blame governments for the problems we have in the world, but they're not the problem. The problem is being the way we behave as individuals and the way we run our businesses. Do you have any comments to make on that, the role of leadership in business and within the community that's going to motivate the government more effectively to take on these bipartisan approaches or more responsible leadership because they feel less threatened by lobby groups?
It's tremendously important, and it's really instructive, for example, in the States, where the Bush administration has got its mind completely set against all these sorts of issues. And so nothing's happening at the federal government. In fact, there's a very important Supreme Court case coming up, which is challenging federal environmental regulators who say that this has nothing to do with us. You know, we don't have the power to regulate carbon dioxide. And so there's a very important Supreme Court case coming up on that. But whereas there's that complete lack of leadership at the federal level, a whole bunch of really, really interesting stuff is happening in corporate America and in the States. And probably the most significant at the corporate level is the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is a voluntary body. And it was started by the very same people who have experience in running commodity exchanges and for 100 years have been doing corn, wheat and soybeans, etc., on the commodity exchanges, realizing there was an opportunity to create a climate exchange. And there was a precursor for this because when the US and Canada were tackling acid rain and therefore there was cap and trading caps on the limits of sulfur dioxide power plants could emit, and then being able to trade credits if you were under that, you could sell those to people who were over it, and so they got a little taste of trading in climate mechanisms. Anyways, but the Chicago Climate Exchange is up and running. It doesn't have any legislation around it. It's just businesses wanting to respond in a responsible way. So immensely important. Here in New Zealand, there's not much leadership. There are fair-sized organisations with a good voice, like the Business Council for Sustainable Development, and its members that take these things seriously. But the main business lobby groups just run a mile from this stuff. Their thinking always comes back to this is a cost that the government's going to impose on them and that they're going to fight every step of the way.
So what opportunities are there for innovative businesses to actually trade on the Chicago trading house?
That's an interesting question. I've just had to think that through. Realistically, I was about to say, the way it's structured at the moment, it wouldn't make a lot of sense for a New Zealand company to commit itself to reducing its greenhouse gas emissions and doing it through the Chicago Climate Exchange. However, what the exchange does is it goes out and creates carbon sinks, and which it can then sell. And the farmer or the landfill operator that's reduced the methane emissions from landfill, those are the people who get a chunk of that revenue. And so, for example, there's a very innovative project with farmers in the Midwest who have done methane reduction in various ways, and then that's sold on the exchange. I actually had a discussion around this issue with a visitor from the Chicago Climate Exchange at a business and climate conference in Adelaide in February, and raised the prospect of a New Zealand farmer or a business group or an investor or a Māori landing corporation or whoever creating carbon sinks that the Chicago Climate Exchange could sell. And that opportunity's there. There's an awful lot needed to do to make it work. It would be exciting to see. Of course, what I'd be much keener to see would be, for example, the New Zealand Stock Exchange starting up a whole climate trading mechanism there. And I've had that discussion with them, and they're interested. They think, yeah, it makes sense, biology-based economy, it's a natural extension. And anyway, you can't buy shares in dairy companies anyway. It's all co-op or privately held. So, yeah, they're interested and they're having a look at it. And that would be really neat if we could get that going on the New Zealand Stock Exchange.
And those are initiatives that can be driven without the government having to take risky political decisions, isn't it?
Yes, but again, having just argued that all this stuff happens in the States without legislation, and that's true, that's not the optimum outcome. The optimum outcome is to get the policy framework right. And so, unfortunately, I always hate to keep coming back to government. There is more to life than government. It would move these issues on a lot, lot faster if there was that rock-solid, long-term policy framework in place.
The Independent, the sister newspaper in London to the New Zealand Herald, has just brought out a very wonderful piece where it mentions that Sky Television, head by Rupert Murdoch's younger son, James Murdoch, has decided to become carbon neutral. And not only that, he is a friend of Al Gore, and Al Gore had his presentation, his film presentation, The Inconvenient Truth, played to all the middle management in Sky, and also now the Sun newspaper, which is an offshoot of Murdoch's too, is now going carbon neutral. And there is a huge impetus. It's like the head of Google, one of the Russians, is very much involved in this process as well. And so we're getting now what you call very well-off young people with green credentials saying we'll use our money to bring about positive change. So I feel that in many cases a tipping point has come in the last few months where top people in business, other than New Zealand, have seen the light and realised now we've got to really take care of our future and, as I say, the children that are growing up today.
My mind immediately leapt to this image of a huge rocket launching the next Sky satellite and somebody calculating what the CO2 emissions would be. That would be a very pretty prodigious carbon offset. And indeed, Sky is launching its next, well, it's Opus out of Australia, but the next Sky satellite goes up, I think, in September, October this year. All of that is very encouraging and very important. But I'd always want to keep testing one important concept with all of that. It's very easy to be smug and satisfied by saying, oh, I'm going to be carbon neutral. I'm just going to buy enough carbon credits. I'm still going to drive my Ferrari or my Bentley or my Toyota or whatever. And as long as I buy the offsets, then that's cool. I'm doing the right thing. Well, yes, but that's only an intermediary step because the real issue is moving beyond carbon energy sources. And I would be very concerned if a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of big companies go racing off after carbon neutrality without thinking about, well, what contribution are they actually making to changing the very nature of energy sources. So I think it's always important to be measuring those commitments against that benchmark.
James Lovelock was interviewed recently where he said New Zealand could be the ark. He honestly sees New Zealand as a repository for information, positive change, etc. And he also talked about sustainable retreat. So there's that other, the opposite coin that we really have to be aware of what we're doing. And as you said, if you're just going to offset your carbon credits and still drive your rollers, that's not really going to be good for the future for kids. So Your optimism is tempered, which I think is very important, because we have to actually do stuff on the ground. It's like our New Zealand railways is a crying shame, where we need to be having, you know, double tracks everywhere. I just went down to Taupo. There's more than one in the car in the weekend, and passed all these toll holdings trucks on the road, and yet they own the railways. And I was sort of upset to see all these trucks here. You do see a definite positive change here, though, don't you?
Yes. I hesitate only because it's glacial and small, but still, often the trend is the thing, and I'm sensing greater awareness. And beginning to say, perhaps we should be thinking about these things on the part of business here in New Zealand.
And won't this be driven by young entrepreneurs that really see opportunities? That's why I mentioned this issue of the Chicago Trading House. Aren't there many, many, many opportunities for young entrepreneurial people to really say, okay, there's a global market out there in this industry, the carbon futures and the global warming reversal industry?
Absolutely. Some of the great technology will come from such people. Some of the great innovations in business process or business systems will come from people like that. But already these issues are attracting a very big commitment from investment banks and the like. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley would be two very good examples of that are raising money from investors to put into technologies or projects of various kinds that make a contribution. But I think here's a great, great irony. On one hand, you've got the world's most profitable bank, HSBC, originally Hong Kong and Shanghai, and still have all sorts of Asian connections, but now London listed. Last year, HSBC decided to make itself carbon neutral, and in the process, which I think is a great thing to do, and in the process bought $800,000 of carbon credits from Meridian Energies to Apatee Wind Farm down in the Manawatu. That's all good. But if you then thought about HSBC, you said, oh, that's kind of cool that, you know, now they've offset all their air travel and everything else. But actually the bigger issue for HSBC is they're very big investors. They lend lots of money to all sorts of projects. Where are they lending their money? Are they still lending it to oil companies? Well, they should, because the oil companies are trying to transition. But the fundamentally bigger issue for HSBC and all those other companies is the money counts hugely.